Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. On Veterans Day, we are dedicating the show to what it means to serve one's country in the military. What's easy? What's hard, and what the rest of us can do to better support those who protect our country, especially when they come home. Now, we will get to some policy. There are plenty of needs, and sometimes our veterans become a tool in policy debates or disputes. But that's not where we're starting. We are going to start with individuals, their stories, their experiences, what they've learned from their own journeys. And we have three folks here in Studio 2 to help us do that. Meredith Tewitt served 14 years as a Navy jet mechanic, both active duty and reserves, and is now the program manager for the Veterans Center at the Harvard Street Neighborhood Health Center. She also sits on the steering committee for the Massachusetts Women's Veterans Network. Meredith, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
U.S. Representative Seth Moulton, Congressman Moulton, is a former Marine, served four tours in Iraq from 2003 to 2008, a guest frequently on Radio Boston. Welcome back, Congressman.
Great to be here. Thanks, DCR.
And U.S. Representative Congressman Jake Auchincloss, also a Marine Corps veteran, active duty from 2010 to 2014, served in Afghanistan and Panama. Welcome back to you as well.
Good to be here.
All right. So I really want to start by thanking all of you for being here today. Increasingly, we have a situation where we have a holiday that we're observing and fewer people who have the lived experience of why we're observing it. And that's what we're hoping to do with this conversation today is understand that better. Meredith, I'm going to start with you and ask you, what made you decide you wanted to serve?
Oh, well, that's a good one, and thank you. You know you let the Navy go first because we come before the Marines. I get to do that. My brother's a leatherneck also. So. I'm aging myself now. Lord, help us. So Boston was one of the home places for junior ROTC programs in the high school systems, and I attended Boston Tech. And Boston Tech, we got Navy JROTC. So I started there and growing in a house with four brothers and, you know, doing sports and learning cars and so on. And I went into JROTC really excited about the hands-on. By my second year in an officer position and then my third year in my junior year, I became a lieutenant commander in the ROTC cadet program. I was really loving it. And I said to my mom, I said, you know, I think I might do this. I might join the military because it seems like what I want to do. I didn't want college, you know. And I like the hands-on piece. And she said, sure, honey, anything you want to do, you know. And she was like, what are you going to go into? Nursing? Or say, I said, no, I'm going to go in and work on jets. I want to, you know, be a jet mechanic. And if I don't get jets, I want to do heavy equipment. And she was like, really? And I was like, yeah. So I did 1 year, one day, delayed entry, 1984 to 1985, and entered boot camp my 18th birthday in Orlando, Florida, and went with it from there, just active duty, then on West Coast, and came back to the East Coast for my reserve time, and my last contract ended January of 1998.
And you did it. You became a jet mechanic.
Yes, ma'am.
So let me turn to you, Seth. You know, I feel like in all the years I've talked to you and known you, we always start with the fact that you served. Let's go back to the choice to serve and talk about that.
Well, it wasn't an obvious choice for me at all. As a student at Harvard with parents who had protested the Vietnam War, but I was inspired by the most influential mentor I've ever had in my life, who was actually the minister at Harvard, the Reverend Professor Peter Gomes, someone that I'm sure a lot of listeners fondly remember. He talked a lot about the importance of service, about how it wasn't enough just to believe in service or support others who serve. You got to find a way to give back yourself. And as I was approaching graduation, I looked at a lot of different options, teaching overseas, Peace Corps. But I just had so much respect at the end of the day for the 18-year-old kids who serve on the front lines of our nation's military that I decided I want to do my part. Now, unlike Meredith, my mother was not so fond of this decision. In fact, sometime after I joined. I think it was in the lead up to Iraq, and everyone was excited and patriotic fervor and whatnot. There was a local Boston paper. Asked my mom, you know, aren't you proud of Seth? And she said, quite famously, I would only have been more disappointed in Seth if he had chosen a life of crime.
Wow. How did that feel?
Authentic. But look, I think that the truth of the matter is that when I tell this story to mothers, they all say, I'm like your mom. I mean, for centuries, moms have not wanted their kids to go to war. But I think coming from the Vietnam era, there was a special tinge to this for my mom. I mean, she went to Brown University, as liberal as they get, and couldn't even understand why someone would want to join the military.
Did she ever come around?
Oh, she's you know, a great supporter now. But I don't think that I would say, I don't want to speak for her, but I think that she respects my service deeply. She still doesn't quite understand why I did it.
So let me turn to you now, Jake. What is the story of you deciding to serve? And we're talking moms, too. So how did your family take it?
I was in college a few years after Seth was, and the patriotic fervor that he describes going into Iraq and in the years after 9/11 really had totally disappeared. I was there 2006 to 2010, where they were starting to feel like the forever wars that they would become. And President Obama announced the surge to Afghanistan. It was seen as a last-ditch effort to turn around a war that was not working. And there were a lot of different threads going into my decision to join up. But one of them was that it felt like I should be fighting a war that a big chunk of the country was fighting, but very few of my friends and classmates even affected their lives. There was also a feeling in my gut that I was going to regret not doing this. I've always tried to make decisions wondering 50 years from now, am I going to regret not having taken this risk? And I just knew in my gut I was going to regret not having challenged myself in this way. I did not even tell my mom. I told her I had an internship with the Department of Defense, which was technically accurate in the sense that Officer Candidate School in Quantico, Virginia reports up through DOD. But I couldn't have that conversation with her, so I told my dad instead and made him tell her after I'd already taken the plunge.
That is so fascinating. You know, I was thinking in preparing for this, Jake, about these DOD commercials that are running where the parent is with the child. And like the kid's in combat and the mom's in her pajamas sitting next to him and they're talking about why he joined. And then at the end of the commercial, you pan back and they're really in his bedroom as he's thinking about joining. There's a lot about now this conversation between parents and kids. If you could go back now, would you do it the same way or would you have told her?
I would totally do it the same way. My mom's scary.
So I'm seeing a nod here, Meredith. I'm interested in the fact that your mom was like, whatever you want, go for it. She had no fear, no trepidation for you?
No, she was very accustomed to my, as they call, eccentricities, you know. Plus, again, I was in a house full of boys, and I had, along the way in my JROTC time, had, you know, kind of sweet-talked my older brother, who was graduating before me, to become a United States Marine because I knew I was going Navy, and if he went Marine, I'd be able to, like, pick on him, right? So he joined the Corps, and once a Marine, always a Marine, and my mom got the ability to go to Paris Island and do all of that. So I had already sweetened my, you know, conversation with her by my brother being in.
He softened her up.
Yes, yeah. So now she was all like, oh, my son's a Marine. Yes. And then she was like, oh, my daughter's going in the Navy. So I was like, really? I got her going on this, you know. And she's into service. She's into public service work. And so it was just like, okay, yeah.
As a black woman who went on to be a jet mechanic, and I understand, you know, that was pretty unusual. I mean, you joined the service in the 80s. Yeah. Do you think you could have done that kind of work and had that kind of training if you hadn't joined the military?
Not at that time. Even after I came out, my dream was to do an FBO and go and work for Delta Airlines or someone. And, you know, instead of working on anti-submarine warfare planes and in HSLs, I wanted to go work on a big 747.
So wait, what's an FBO? I don't know what that is.
Oh, fixed based operator in the airport. Sorry. Okay. Yeah. like Logan, mm-hmm. the smaller versions, though, I wanted to do. So I came out and went to East Coast Aerotech, and the training and the work there was smooth for me because I was already, you know, in it. And then I got detoured. I rode to Spain. You know, I went over and did some time. And by the time I came back, you know, I didn't get to finish up. And then I got involved in politics and never went back. So it was just. But it was good. It was an experience, but it was a learning experience going through mech shops where I was the only woman of color, or being my first unit. There was three of us that were female, and I was the only woman of color, and it was a different treatment, different. Coming from the islands. And then coming to Boston and experiencing Boston during busing and things like that when I was young. And then going into the military, I was ready. I had already experienced it here.
Isn't that interesting?
How it was being, you know, what it was like. And then it was an experience for me because I was able to meet different people, Filipinos and so on, and just experience different cultures. But on the military base, you know, and yeah.
We're speaking with Meredith Tewitt, Representative Jake Auchincloss, and Representative Seth Moulton, all who are veterans on this special Veterans Day episode. So, Seth and Jake, I am struck by, and Seth, you touched on this point first, this idea that when the three of you served, we were at three different times of attitude about the U.S. military as well. I mean, you want to talk about Vietnam being fresh in people's minds, Meredith. Yeah. The 1980s, yes. I mean, we're talking a decade out.
Yes.
And then, Seth, we were at a kind of fervor. You know, you were, what, 2003 to 2008, active duty. Is that right?
Well, that's right, but 2002 to 2008. But I made the decision to join before September 11th.
Interesting.
And I think that was the hardest part for people to understand. I mean, my classmates thought I was nuts. I mean, they were furious with me. I mean, one of them, used to have breakfast with him almost every day, and I remember he slammed his tray on the table and walked out of breakfast because he just thought I was throwing my life away, and he didn't want to see one of his best friends do that. It's a few years later, he joined the Army.
How long did he serve? And how many years later? I mean that's fascinating.
American hero. He hit Purple Heart in Iraq. But the point is that the sentiment changed, that before September 11th, no one could understand why you would want to sign up for the military if you had other options and, you know, lots of things ahead of you. And then all of a sudden, there were lines up in front of recruiting stations. And I mean, I was proud to have made that decision before. But my parents, I think, still really struggled to understand it. I remember at one point my mom said, well, now that there's actually a war, I thought you would have changed your mind.
Did you think about changing your mind once there was actually a war?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is all of a sudden I was vindicated. All those friends who had criticized me were now thinking about serving themselves.
So I hear you. I'm going to actually sort of turn to you, Jake, to ask my follow-up question of Seth, which is, okay, but is none of this scary? I mean, this is the idea to choose to serve, and you are in theaters of combat, and you knew. And you, Seth, when you were like, absolutely, now I was vindicated, you knew there was no fear there, no trepidation.
The scariest thing for me was the idea of failing in public. Thing about officer candidate school, basic officer course, infantry officer course, basic reconnaissance course, the whole pipeline of training is, depending on the class, depending on the needs of the Marine Corps, somewhere between a third to a half of that class isn't going to make it through. They're going to fail that course. And they're going to fail in a pretty public fashion. You're going to fail a physical test, an academic test, a leadership test. And nobody likes failing in public. It's embarrassing, and it dings your self-confidence. And at the age of 22, 23, you're at, in some ways, I think, most vulnerable to that kind of social pressure. And so the idea of sort of physical harm, I think, was kind of abstract to me still, but the idea of failing in public was very real to me, and that was very nerve-wracking, partly why I didn't tell a lot of people I was joining and was always extremely stressed out throughout the entire regimen of training, as I just didn't want to fail. And I think that's kind of everyone's kind of pictures in their head these Civil War movies where you see these guys marching in lockstep into cannon fire, and you ask yourself, how could you keep on taking a step forward? And I think the answer is a lot of those guys were more scared to turn around than they were to walk forward, because abandoning your friends and being seen by your friends to fail would have been the scariest thing imaginable.
It's striking, Meredith and Seth, you're both vigorously nodding to that.
Yeah. It's the life when you, as a veteran or military attached in a way, trying to educate and talk to a civilian friend about what it means to service to the country. When you sign that paper and you go in, so my comrade brothers that are sitting here, Marine Corps brothers, when you go through your training and you go through boot camp, you're building something that you have already inside. It's the structure, the rigor, the discipline, all of that is being enhanced and enforced. You walk in one way and you walk out walking taller, head up, shoulder back. You have a little bit more respect for yourself and your colleagues and your brothers and your sisters that you're walking with differently. And it is going forward more than going back. Going back is like you're letting them down. You're letting your family down. You're letting yourself down. So the fear is that failure. Even if you're enlisted or an officer, it's still there. It still exists that you don't want to fail, you know. And the struggles with the parents and the families understanding. I had friends that kind of looked at me like, you're doing what? And every time I came home on leave, you know, and I came home in uniform, they were like, you're still in? It was just...
And you were in for 14 years.
Yes. Yeah.
It's this extraordinary experience of being part of something bigger than yourself.
Yeah.
And I think most Americans don't have that experience today. We're a very self-centered culture, at least it seems like we've become that way. Everybody can find their own worlds on their own social media platforms, and the military is very different. You really are a part of a team that depends for life and death on one another. And I remember those same feelings. I mean, Jake's, you know, feeling of, like, the worst thing in the world would be to fail, to let people down. But there also, to be honest, were times where I was just outright scared too. And I remember a night in Iraq, lying in the mud. I don't think I've ever been colder in my life, and I'm from New England. It was cold. And we got an intelligence report that more or less translated into, you're probably going to be wiped out. And I remember thinking at that moment, you know, all my friends are back home in Boston. They're probably at bars right now having a good time. And I'm about to die in this patch of mud in a town nobody's heard of, in a war that probably shouldn't have been fought. What the hell am I doing here? But I had that thought for about 10 seconds, and then I came back to why I'm here, which is I didn't want someone to go fight in my place. And that realization suddenly made me recognize that actually I'm exactly where I want to be. And as hard as this is, it's for moments like this that I'm here. And now when people come up to me and they ask, you know, they're thinking about serving and they're asking, you know, why did you serve and am I making the right decision? I always say, you know, make sure you have some real principled reasons for wanting to serve. Don't just do this because it's a good opportunity, a good thing on your resume. You'll get a good job afterwards. Make sure you really understand why you want to do this, because there may be some time like that moment in the mud where you have to fall back on those first principles just to get you through.
We're bringing you a special hour this Veterans Day, talking with a panel of people who have served. Still with us, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton and Jake Auchincloss, both served as Marines. Won't even call you former Marines. Once a Marine, all a Marine, always a Marine. And Meredith Tuitt, who serves in the Navy and is now program manager for the Veterans Center at the Harvard Street Neighborhood Health Center, also a member of the Massachusetts Women's Veterans Network Steering Committee. We had been talking about this decision to serve, those early moments of serving, how family supported you, et cetera. Jake Auchincloss, eventually you decided to stop serving in active duty military. How did that decision come around?
I got back from Afghanistan in summer of 2012, and to be blunt, it had been a miserable deployment. We were overseas patrolling through three Taliban-contested villages and just had no mission statement. Marine officers are taught first and foremost, understand the commander's intent. A lot of things might change on the ground, but if you understand the commander's overall intent, you can improvise, adapt, and overcome to achieve it. We just did not understand the commander's intent there. We were pulling back in real time, and it was very low morale, very hard to understand the tactics that should follow from our strategic situation there. So very low morale. And my unit was not going to be redeploying because the surge had been winding down. And so we were going to go into basically what were called MUs, expeditionary units that were going to be on boats throughout the Pacific. And I wanted one more deployment to have a good deployment. And the way to do that, ironically, was not to stay in active duty, but was to go into the reserves and to go into a reconnaissance unit in the reserves that was going to be deploying to Panama. And so I was able to go through recon training, which is the Marine Corps' internal special operations unit, and then go to a reserve recon unit and command a joint special operations mission to Panama to do training with the Panamanian Public Forces. That was a superb mission. We understood exactly what we were doing. It was the U.S. military at its best, leveraging its capabilities and its alliances to train a host country to do missions in perpetuity that the U.S. military would not have to be doing now. So I got to see both the worst and the best deployment of U.S. military force overseas.
Did that save you from being disillusioned?
A big part of it, yes. I don't know that I would say I was disillusioned when I got back from Afghanistan, because I believed then and believe now in the U.S. Marine Corps and the U.S. military's competence and the nobility of its purpose. I think there was just grotesque political failure in Washington, D.C. I mean, the military, at the end of the day, takes its orders from the civilians.
Seth, I'm just going to turn to you.
Jake's right. I mean, that's why I ran for Congress, because of how I saw Washington fail in Iraq and let us down on the ground.
And you kind of served roughly, right, through the arc, right? The arc,
right,
that was the beginning of into, wait a minute. And that was sort of your time. Is that,
that's the least
technical way I could possibly explain that. But
I was in the invasion when we were going overseas to save America, to save the world, and everyone was behind us. And then I came back for some of the worst fighting of the Iraq War, and things were getting a lot worse. And then I came back again during the surge when things seemed to be getting better. That's what you describe as the arc. But I want to just point out, we often think about the war in those terms, and yet the end of my arc wasn't even the middle of these wars. I never would have imagined when I came back in 2008 that we weren't even halfway through.
What made you decide to go, to leave the military?
For me, it was a very difficult decision, because by that point, much like Jake, I was quite critical of the war. I mean, I had even somehow managed to get an op-ed in the New York Times as a Marine, highly critical of Iraq. And shortly thereafter, I went back for another deployment because I didn't want anyone to go in my place. I mean, I'll tell you a quick, even better story about this. One of my good friends from the Marines got out about that time, I think 2007. And when he got out, he came out of the closet. And of course, this was under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So he wasn't allowed to be gay in the military. But then after he was out and out, he got called back. He got a letter in the mail saying, We need you for the surge. And all he had to do was pick up the phone and say two words to the Department of Defense. I'm gay. And no one would have asked any other questions. He would not have had to go. But instead, he went back into the closet so that he could go on another deployment and no one would have to go in his place. That's the ethic of service in our military. And that's why it was so hard for me to get out.
Meredith, in your work now at the Veterans Center at the Harvard Street Neighborhood Health Center, are these stories that you hear, does this resonate in the people that you're supporting now?
Yes, all the time. For a while, because before I started working at Harvard Street, I'm a Legionnaire, so American Legion, and commander of my post, and before senior vice. So the stories and having conversations with my World War II brothers, my Vietnam brothers and sisters, Korean, what these two brothers went through were almost what happened to our Vietnam brothers, our Korean brothers, and the Grenada invasion. If you look at those three eras and how the military attached men and women were treated, that's how these brothers served from 2000 through to 2011 through on that arc, as Congressman Seth is talking about. That's how they were treated. The shame and how dare you, or you're doing something really awesome, and then thanks for helping those people out. So it was three different eras, but all in one. War, mission, battle. So having the conversations and learning is a way that we are now able to, and I use it in the center to be able to talk to my friends in legislature and talk to other people about how we can improve for those that are coming out or those that are going to serve in the future, how we should treat and how we should assist and make it better.
So I do want to note for listeners, Grenada was 1983, October of 1983. So we are talking really, as you say, Meredith, about a series of eras. I wonder, and any of the three of you can answer this, what is hard about leaving the military and coming back to civilian life? That
like
you're the
everything?
First to laugh.
Everything.
You laugh first, son. You go.
I mean, let me be honest. I had it made. I had a seat at Harvard Business School. I had an incredibly loving family and a wonderful group of supportive friends. And despite all of that, I found it very hard. I mean, there were times when I would just be sitting in the back of this very privileged classroom at Harvard and thinking to myself, like, what am I doing? This is so meaningless compared to what I was just doing in Iraq. Because even in the midst of a war I disagreed with, every single day, my work impacted the lives of other people. And like we just discussed, I knew that there were many of my friends still there, still doing that critical work. And sure, I had this great opportunity. I mean, I'm all for education, but I was basically just enriching myself going to grad school. So there were moments like that where I felt really detached. I didn't feel like I was pursuing a real purpose. There were times when my classmates could just see that I kind of seemed lost and out of touch. I think these were early symptoms of post-traumatic stress, but they were certainly just an experience of being very difficult to adjust to life back home.
How about for you, Jake?
I have not had similar sensations to Seth, but I also was in nowhere near the kind of combat situations that he was in for the number of tours that he was in. What I miss most is the sense of satisfaction for jobs completed. The military is a very task-oriented profession, and you wake up and you've got a hard day and you've got very discrete challenges ahead of you that you can accomplish. And now I'm in Congress, and the ability to check things off your list is much diminished, and I do hunger for that. Sometimes my wife and I joke, I got two little kids at home, and I find it very therapeutic to actually to pick up their toys in the evening, and I put them all away because it's like I accomplished something, and it's everything's organized and neat, and something is done that day, and I miss the military gives you a lot of those opportunities.
So, Meredith, using my words, not mm-hmm. yours, you told one of our producers that when you left the military, as a woman, you said earlier, you know, you stood up a little taller, you had a little more, that you felt pressure to make yourself smaller again
yeah.
when you left.
Transitional trauma. We all go through it, and we don't recognize it. We don't talk about it. And when I came back, I didn't want to come back, even from reserves, I still wanted to do, but I was higher tenured, so they wouldn't give me another contract. And I have to say, I'm really, really military love, right? Desert Storm, I was pregnant with my son. They wouldn't let me go. I cried because I wanted to go. So I served during peacetime. I hate when people say that to me. Oh, you served during peacetime. But I still served. I still did a lot of work. I still saw a lot of things. At my time, I was able to touch 3 different carrier decks, and, you know, we were on a training unit, so we were able to take our pilots out to learn how to land on the carriers, which at the time was still fresh, so 2 weeks at a time we were allowed. But when I came back, I left this really mousy young girl, 114 pounds, you know, I came back 116 pounds, and you couldn't tell me anything now. Now I walk tall, and, you know, my brothers would pick on me, and we'd fight, we'd tussle. But when I went to job interviews, because I was confident about myself, the terms that were used for me was she's overconfident. She's, you know, bold. She's too bold. She's too, you know, so the things that women have to already fight over and try to over, you know, compensate for, it became harder for me, especially with my, especially with other women, you know. I had to go through, you know, trying to lessen myself, trying to tone it down, try to, you know, fall under the radar a little bit. So that's where a lot of the I Am Invisible project came out of, where female veterans felt that they were invisible. And then when we came home, we had to kind of hide a little bit. So it was harder. And I'm listening to the brothers, and I'm saying, wow, you know, I'm really old.
Oh, come on.
I'm like, what? Oh. So, but it is that transitional trauma. Your peers don't understand you. So you kind of milk it down a little bit.
We are bringing you a special full-hour conversation on what it means to be a veteran in the Commonwealth. Still with us, United States Congressmen Seth Moulton and Jake Auchincloss, both served in the U.S. Marines, and Meredith Tewitt, Navy veteran and member of the Massachusetts Women's Veterans Network Steering Committee. We're going to add another voice here. Jenny D. Olympia is an Air Force veteran and director of the Military Veteran Psychology and Train Vets to Treat Vets programs at William James College. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Jenny, I'm going to give you first a minute to just respond, react to the things that you've heard in the conversation that the rest of us have been having.
I think the first thought I have is when I told my mother that I was going to join the military, it was sort of similar. My mom said, this is not a conversation that we have over the phone. This conversation is over. So I had to go home and tell her, you know, I'm joining the Air Force. I talked to all the services before I got in. I always dreamed of being in the military from sixth grade when I did my first persuasive speech that women should have equal opportunity if they had equal skills. And that finally came to be in 2015. And I think that's, you know, one thing that I sort of connect to. I think listening to how hard it was in readjustment, listening to the discussion about how hard it was for women to come back into the world, it's hard for all veterans as far as readjustment. We all have to deal with readjustment no matter what we did or where we went in the military. But for women veterans, we don't have a peer group when we come back because there are so few women who do serve, and the women around us don't really understand, you know, why we did that. I think that's another connection that I felt.
So, Jenny, part of the reason we wanted to add you to the conversation, excuse me, we're going to move now into how we as a Commonwealth community best support people who are serving and have served. And one of the things that you work on is train vets to treat vets. Seth, you've worked a lot on mental health. Jake, you've talked a lot about public policy and veterans. You're working in programming for the, you know, veterans care, Meredith. Jenny, what do you think is the top imperative here, here at home, in Massachusetts home right now, in terms of best supporting our people who have served?
I think realizing that anyone in your community could be a veteran. They could be very young, have very small children, or they could be, you know, older and wearing a hat that says, I'm a veteran and this is where I served. I think it could be a woman or it could be anyone in the community. I think extending our appreciation and value to all community members who've served in any capacity is really important. I think it's important to connect us to all the different services that are available, mental health services, readjustment services. We have a lot of services available, but the web is very difficult to navigate for people. And especially if you are already frustrated with a system, it can be even more difficult to navigate. So anything we can do to help people connect and navigate that system, I think is really helpful.
So Seth, I'll turn to you here. I'm thinking about 988. Which you advocated for. It's a mental health crisis line, much easier to remember, went into effect earlier this year. I'm going to play a little sound from Christine Rizza, volunteer manager for Samaritan South Coast, one of five centers in Massachusetts that receives calls from 988. And she said calls more than doubled since 988 went online. And state public health officials say statewide calls to those centers have gone up by 30% since the number went into effect. Here she is.
From April 1st until July 16th, we had 754 calls. July 16th to today, we have received 2,639 calls. So it has increased dramatically.
As we get people more willing to reach out, as we have more services, are we able to reduce the stigma, especially for veterans who are struggling with PTSD, suicidal thinking? And again, if you are that person, you can dial 988 and receive assistance.
Well, I think we can. And that's been the most amazing part of this 988 conversation. This is my bill. I worked on it with a fellow veteran across the aisle. And we passed it because we knew that there are so many Americans every year who die by suicide because in that moment, they're alone. The most important moment of their life, they can't get help. Over 50,000 Americans, good Americans, can't get the help that they deserve when they need it most. And we knew if you could remember a three-digit number just like 911, more people would be able to call and get that assistance. That's what you're seeing in these rising numbers. But the other thing that's happened is that having this conversation about 988 has helped reduce the stigma and made people realize that you don't have to be afraid to call. You know, you don't have to feel embarrassed that your house is on fire and be afraid to call 911. You should not be embarrassed that you or a loved one has a mental health condition and needs to call 988. And I think that's helpful for veterans. It's helpful for everybody in America who's touched by mental health issues, which is pretty much just about everyone.
Just about everyone. Jake, what else do you see as imperative? You know, you talked about literally cleaning up the toys at home at night because you want to feel like you finished something now that you're in Congress. What's the dream on behalf of veterans for you as somebody serving now as an elected official?
Don't fight wars of choice. There's been a lot of public commentary in the last few years about how did America's corrosive political environment develop? What happened? Because it wasn't like this after 9/11, right? We can all think back to the flags in every porch and the sense of unity and common purpose. And certainly that was going to be fleeting broadly, but it didn't have to descend to where it's gotten to now. And I think a very likely candidate for that was 2003, was George Bush's decision to invade Iraq based on lies, let's call it what it is. And future presidents need to take heed that decisions like that can become a tumor in the body politic and not just harm veterans, but really harm our entire democracy. Future commander-in-chiefs need to not fight wars of choice.
Jenny, what do you think when you hear Jake say that?
I think that's that makes a lot of sense for going forward. I think another thing, too, to think about is opening up access to our mental health, to mental health providers throughout the VA and the through the military hiring process. There are many qualified individuals who've gone through rigorous state licensing processes that don't have access to work at the VA or at the DOD facilities, even though they have a state license, and there's a shortage of mental health providers. That's only going to increase as more people access mental health care. So I think that's something else that can be helpful, is opening up, you know, access to our providers.
And why do they not have that access now?
Because the VA requires individuals with a master's degree to have a KCRUP accreditation, which is not what is the standard in every state. Every state has a rigorous requirement that's a little bit, that might be a little bit different for individuals in order to work for the VA or the Department of Defense.
That seems fixable, Jake.
Agreed. And this is a problem not just in veteran services, but across the healthcare and human services industries. I call it the paper ceiling. We use occupational licensing restrictions to really prevent people from practicing to the top of their license. And especially right now, at a time when you've got one American looking for every two open jobs, we need people maximizing their skill set, especially those who are helping veterans and others who are vulnerable. And that is going to require a mix of federal and state changes.
And Meredith, you've talked in the past about even just the frustrations of having to retrain once you leave the military to do the job you were already doing, and not you personally, although that also happened to you personally, but that in general, there's that side of things that we need to improve as well.
And yes, but can I jump back? I'm sorry.
What
everyone was talking about here. Years. So I don't look crazy when I'm saying this. So I worked many a years as chief legislative staffer for State Representative Gloria Fox about 12 years or so before she retired. So working on Beacon Hill in politics, very familiar with legislation and law. And everything they're talking about, 988 is awesome. I love it because it's so, so important. There's quick three numbers. And we were losing brothers and sisters because to think about a long number, just having someone to talk to. But here's the thing to piggyback on everybody else. Institutional racism. No matter what changes occur, no matter 988, no matter what they do on getting licenses and so on, if there's not people that look like me, that understands me, understands the veterans of color, understands everyone, diverse cultural competency, everything that sits at the table, no matter what you do, it's not going to help. It's not going to work. Because I have colleagues who sit at the tables, and I know a couple of the young ladies that are going through the train the vets to fix the
to treat court, vets.
Treat vets. And I'm saying one of the things that I talk about all the time, and I'll get to your question. I'm sorry. It just jumped in
Stay
my head.
Here. You don't have to get to my question. Yeah. Stay on this.
And it... if we sit at the table and we have PTS, we have MST, we have all of these suicidal, we have all of this trauma going through us, and we're sitting down at the table with a clinician or a counselor or someone that's supposed to be helping us, even if they are a veteran and they understand our terminologies and what we're talking about, because civilians sometimes don't get it. But even then, and you don't understand what we're saying to you because where our pigmentation is different to your pigmentation, because you have those, unconscious biases, how are you going to help us? How are you going to help me? I'm not asking you to fix me. I'm asking you to understand me, right? And that's one of the things that we are missing, even in all of the policies that we are doing and fixing, right? If you don't understand what I'm saying to you when I'm walking down the street, as a female veteran of color or a male veteran of color, right? All you're seeing is an angry black man or an angry black woman. And when I'm sitting at the table saying to you, I'm having night terrors. I can't sleep at night. I'm going to bed and laying in bed or laying under the bed. And I can't get anybody to talk to me because I'm coming across angry or I need angry management. No matter what training you do, it's not going to help unless you're really talking about the right training.
So I thank you for that. I just want to, MST is military sexual trauma.
Sorry.
You just use, it's okay. You just use an acronym that maybe not all of our listeners would know. So Seth Moulton, I'll turn back to you. I'm mindful we have just a couple of minutes left. I'm going to have you pick up that thread, and then Jenny, I'm going to come back to you one more time.
Well, I mean, Meredith is absolutely right. I mean, this is one of the hardest parts of coming home is just being able to relate to people, not just people in your community, but people who can help you through whatever issues you might have. And I loved how Meredith used another acronym that not everyone might know, PTS. That's post-traumatic stress. Note that she did not say post-traumatic stress disorder. One of my best friends in the Marines who I served with said to me once, Seth, you know, after what we went through, it would be a disorder if you weren't affected by it. And so what people need to understand about veterans is that, sure, some of us have post-traumatic stress, but that's actually a pretty normal reaction to the experiences that we had, and it's treatable. You have to find the right people to treat you, like Meredith said, but you can get through these experiences, and then you can be a wonderful contributor to our society. Veterans have so much to offer. Veterans disproportionately do better in business. They're more involved in civics. They vote at higher rates. They actually have higher lifetime earnings, but you just got to get over that hump, that transition with coming home. You know, I'm proud of my service. I love the Marine Corps. But I don't wish my experience on anyone. Sometimes people ask me, Seth, you've got two little girls. Would you be proud of them being United States Marines? And the answer is yes, I'd be proud of them, but I'd be even more proud if we didn't need a Marine Corps when they grow up. That's what we're all striving for. But until we get to that point, I think we've got to recognize that veterans who have given so much still have a lot to offer when they come home.
And actually, that both thematically and time-wise is a good place for us to end. So this has been our special one-hour Veterans Day show here on Radio Boston. I want to thank all of our guests. You just heard U.S. Congressman and Marine veteran Seth Moulton, also U.S. Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who served in the Marines in Afghanistan and Panama, Jenny D'Olimpia, Air Force veteran, director of the Military Veteran Psychology and Train Vets to Treat Vets programs at William James College, and Meredith Tuitt, veteran and member, Navy veteran, and member of the Massachusetts Women's Veterans Network Steering Committee. It was a lot to give to spend a full hour with us today. Thank you to all four of you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
That's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for more Radio Boston.